Why don't we start, Erica, by having you introduce us to Ona Judge. Tell us how she came to be a slave for the Washingtons.
Sure. I met Ona Judge about 17-ish years ago when I was doing some archival work. And I was looking through old 18th century newspapers. And I came across a runaway slave advertisement. And it was a runaway slave advertisement from a Philadelphia newspaper, and I thought that was sort of odd. And I read the language, and it said, absconded from the household of the President of the United States. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. This isn't just your everyday runaway slave advertisement. This is, and so I'm doing the math in my head. It's 1796. That's George Washington. Who's he running after? And this advertisement introduced me to Ona for the first time. Ona was born sometime in 1773 or 74. We don't have an exact birth date for her. The Washingtons, like many other slave owners, did not record the birth dates of the enslaved. However, with sort of corroborating evidence, we were able to sort of pretty much be certain that she's born 1773, 74. Her mother was an enslaved woman named Betty. And Betty was a seamstress and a spinner, and she was actually technically owned by Martha Washington. Martha Washington and George Washington both owned slaves. They kept them very sort of separate in their listings. They did two slave censuses in the 18th century, and it was very clear whose slaves were Martha's and who belonged to George. Martha Washington, though, was the one with the majority of the slaves. Mm. And she, I joked today with the students that when George married Martha, you know, as my grandmother would say, he came up, he married into some money. And part of that wealth came from human property. And so when she came to Mount Vernon, she brought Betty, Ona's mother. And Ona's father was a white indentured servant. It's interesting to sort of think about Washington having both enslaved people working at his home at Mount Vernon, but also purchasing the indenture agreements of white men. Andrew Judge was from England. He was a tailor. Ona's mother, Betty, was a seamstress and a spinner. I don't know the nature of their relationship. I don't know if it was consensual. I don't know if it was sexual attack. What I do know is at the end, at some point, Ona was born. And the Washingtons were very careful to note her surname. And that kind of distinguished her from many of the other enslaved men and women at Mount Vernon, because most of them did not have a surname. They had no last name. But in most of the records, Ona, who they called Oni, and I argue that that's the diminutive of her name, like a nickname, she goes by Ona at the end of her life, so that's what I call her. Most of the enslaved did not have surnames. She did.
Would that have been because her father was white?
Yeah, most certainly.
And so and it clearly was known that he was the father. So there may have been some relationship, actual relationship between him
there may
and
have
Betty.
Been. And yeah. And that was my sort of initial sort of thought or response, because there were other enslaved people at Mount Vernon who we know had white fathers through forced breeding or rape, and their last names were not attached to the enslaved. And so it became interesting for me what happened to Andrew Judge. And eventually he works off his indenture agreement and he leaves. He leaves Mount Vernon and he leaves behind, of course, Ona and Betty and has his own family in Virginia. So his story at Mount Vernon ends in the 1780s at a moment in which Ona is coming of age and at the age of 10 is asked to go up to the mansion house. Her work assignment has begun, and she's to become a spinner and a seamstress and to work in the mansion house. And over a period of a couple of years, she becomes Martha Washington's sort of top slave. I don't have a better term for that, but she's her preferred slave. Important to note, the Washingtons don't use the term slave. ever. They always referred to the enslaved as servants. And so she would call Ona her preferred servant.
Mm-hmm. And this would be, have been a preferential position, being a slave for the mistress of the house in a mansion?
Well, you know, I have very mixed feelings about that. Mm-hmm. I think that part of what I was trying to do with Never Caught is to blow open wide some of the myths we have about slavery. And one of those myths is that to work in the house, to be a house slave, to be preferred by Martha Washington would have been a preferential job. And in some ways, in terms of material gain, it may have been. Perhaps you had better clothing or extra food given to you at the end of supper. But it also meant that your work never ended, that you were constantly on call, day in, day out. When your owner was sick, you were up at night with your sick owner and emptying the privy. If the grandchildren were sick, you helped them. And so I argue that this position of being in the house and being Martha Washington's top preferred slave put her under a constant microscope and didn't really allow her. She didn't live in the slave quarters later on. That's a place where, as difficult of the conditions of the slave quarters, kind of crudely built, uninsulated, many folks sort of living in there, it wasn't your owner's house. You weren't living, breathing constantly around him or her. And so while there may have been material advantages, I think, you know, I try to trouble or complicate this idea of that being a preferential position.
So Ona was a slave at Mount Vernon, but when George Washington was elected president and it was time to move to the capital, first New York, then Philadelphia, she went along, right?
She did.
And you write about that, leaving Mount Vernon in your book. Would you read that for us now?
Sure.
It's a lovely passage.
I'm happy to. This is the moment, a sort of difficult moment in Ona's life, a moment that she is forced to travel with six other enslaved men and women from Virginia to New York. The young Ona Judge was far from an experienced traveler. The teenager knew only Mount Vernon and its surroundings and had never traveled far from her family and loved ones. For Judge, the move must have been similar to the dreaded auction block. Although she was not to be sold to a different owner, she was forced to leave her family for an unfamiliar destination hundreds of miles away. Judge would have had no choice but to stifle the terror she felt and go on about the work of preparing to move, folding linens, packing Martha Washington's dresses and personal accessories, helping with the grandchildren, were the tasks at hand. And it wasn't her place to complain or question. Judge had to remain strong and steady, if not for herself, then for her mistress, who appeared to be falling apart at the seams. Like Judge, Martha Washington had no choice about the move to New York. Her life was at the direction of her husband, who was now the most powerful man in the country. Mrs. Washington and Ona Judge may have shared similar concerns, but of course only Martha Washington was allowed to express discontent and sorrow. Martha Washington was unhappy, and everyone knew it, including her frightened slave. The president's nephew, Robert Lewis, would also soon be made aware of it. When he arrived at the estate on May 14th, things were in disarray. Lewis, who served as Washington's secretary between 1789 and 91, was chosen to escort his aunt and her grandchildren to New York. but was surprised and a bit concerned when he arrived to find a frenzied and hectic scene. Lewis wrote, quote, "Everything appeared to be in confusion," end quote. The manifestation of Mrs. Washington's conflicting feelings. Robert Lewis described the departure which finally took place on May 16, 1789, as an emotional moment for the slaves and the First Lady. He wrote, "After an early dinner and making all necessary arrangements, in which we were greatly retarded, it brought us to 3 o'clock in the afternoon when we left Mount V. The servants of the house and a number of the field Negroes made their appearance to take leave of their mistress. Numbers of these poor wretches seemed greatly agitated, much affected. My aunt equally so. Betty, Ona Judge's mother, must have been one of those agitated slaves. Not only was she losing her 16-year-old daughter, but she was also losing her son, Austin, who would serve as one of the Washington's waiters. Austin's wife, Charlotte, and their children would have joined in the mourning. Betty watched her children leave Mount Vernon, a reminder of what little control enslaved mothers had over the lives of their children. If she found any comfort that day, it would have been that brother and sister were traveling together. Austin was older and male and could look out for his younger sister. But still, Betty knew that her relationship with her children would never be the same.
Thank you. So after an arduous journey, they end up in Philadelphia. Very different place in terms of slavery, and there are free blacks, mm-hmm. some slaves, but very different in New York, pardon me. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about how that changed Ona's perspective on slavery and may have led to her beginning to think about being free.
Yeah, no, I think that it's very clear that Ona leaves and goes to New York at the age of 16, 17 years old. And it's the first time she really experiences a home, a place, where she can actually see black freedom. Mm. Now, there's still a significant number of enslaved people in New York. The governor has slaves, founding father types who are New Yorkers own slaves. But there's still a growing population of free people. And so this would have been really her first encounter with it. She was not, it was not a rarity for the Washingtons to bring enslaved people. But it was, as I said, this first moment, this first glimpse of possibility.
And then a few years later, they moved to Philadelphia, which is even more interesting for her. Partly because Pennsylvania has decided that it is going to abolish slavery, over gradually abolish slavery. Mm-hmm. And the Washingtons get some interesting news about their slaves that suggests they may be in danger of losing them, right?
Yeah, there's this, you know, one of the other things I wanted to do with the book was to show the difference between sort of northern states and slavery, and also to blow open this myth that the North was free and the South was enslaved, right? That's the sort of misnomer, the mythic understanding we have of American history. And what we see through Ona, through Ona's travels to New York and then to Pennsylvania and then eventually later on to New England, that she has a very different experience in all of these places. And so that when she arrives in Pennsylvania, she is actually in the minority in terms of being an enslaved person. There are 250 or so enslaved people in Philadelphia in 1790 when the Washingtons arrive. there's 6,000 or 7,000 free blacks. So black freedom is palpable. She sees it. Black men and women are entrepreneurs, and they're selling pepper pot soup, and they're running boarding houses, and they're founding Mother Bethel Church around the corner, and they're building community. And she's still enslaved. And this becomes problematic for the Washingtons, no matter how much they keep the enslaved from, or try to keep the enslaved from, a free black community. The laws provide a problem for the Washingtons. And the gradual abolition law in Pennsylvania basically said that if you were a non-resident and you came to Pennsylvania and you brought your slaves with you, you could only stay for 6 months. And if you stayed longer than 6 months, your slaves were set free. And so the Washingtons find out about this from the Attorney General, who basically says, look, my slaves just repeated the law back to me and they're gone because I overstayed 6 months. So you got a problem. And it's at this moment, as a historian, when I'm sort of reading through Washington's letters that go back and forth between Washington and his secretary, he's very clear about how to handle this problem. And George Washington creates a slave rotation plan. And every 6 months, he would rotate his slaves out of Philadelphia, out of the state of Pennsylvania, back to Virginia, basically restarting the clock on slavery. And if that was an inconvenience, if they kind of couldn't get it together to make a trip to Virginia, a quick trip to Trenton, New Jersey, over the river would basically do the same thing. And he writes in his letter that he wishes to do this and to deceive them, meaning the slaves, and the public, and that this advice should only be known to Tobias Lear, his secretary, and Martha Washington.
But of course, the slaves find out about it.
Of course. You can't keep that right from people but too right long, right? And that's that shows us the power of the oral tradition. And you know, this is a community in which the majority of black men and women can't read, but they still know the law.
So this got Ona thinking about freedom.
Sure.
And then she finds that she may be given to Martha Washington's niece, Eliza Custis.
Granddaughter.
Mm-hmm. Granddaughter, Eliza Custis, who she doesn't like at all. And so she starts to think about leaving.
Yeah.
And finally does. Give us a quick description of how she manages that and where
yeah
she ends up.
She finds out, you know, even though she's the preferred slave of Martha Washington, she finds out that she's going to be given away as a wedding gift to Martha Washington's granddaughter, a woman named Eliza Custis Law, who Ona did not like at all. Lots of folks didn't. And it's this, I argue, and in the book, I argue that it's this change in her ownership that pulls the trigger on her decision to flee. That seeing black freedom around her was, of course, at a moment in which she's coming of age, right? She's in her late teens, early 20s, and she sees the possibility around her. But it's this act, the act in which she realized that she's really not the preferred slave, that there is no such thing, right? That enslaved men and women were disposable, interchangeable. And when she understands this, she makes the decision to flee. And with the help of the free black community in Philadelphia, she packs her things in secret. And on May 21st, 1796, she leaves the Washington's house while they ate their supper. And she never returned. But that wasn't, of course, the end of the story.
No. She takes a boat to Portsmouth.
Yeah.
And is free, but she's risking a huge amount. It's dangerous to be a fugitive slave, even in the North, because of the Fugitive Slave Act that George Washington signed.
Sure. So it's, you know, she leaves and she finds her way to Portsmouth. which at first I was like, Portsmouth, like, why there? No disrespect to Portsmouth, you know, it's a lovely place. Been there a whole lot. But I thought, why there? And then, of course, you know, it became kind of clear that this was a place that had a sort of developing port city. It was still small, and she might not be recognized. You know, Ona was a high-profile person. Everywhere Martha Washington went, Ona went with her. So she was known. Her face was known. She was sort of, you know, popular, or at least understood as a connection to the Washington household.
Right.
And so her decision, when she leaves and goes to Portsmouth, she finds herself never free. And I think that's important to make this distinction that, you know, there's the myth that, oh, you run to the north and you're free. Well, no, it means you're not with your owner. And that's the reason why I named the book Never Caught. A distinction between being free and never caught. Ona was never free. She was simply never caught.
And she was never caught, but had she been caught, we know that President Washington might have dealt with her harshly.
Sure.
And I think there's a passage that you write about his condoning of the whipping of one of his house slaves, Charlotte, another seamstress in the house. Would you read that, please?
Sure. This is from the sort of middle of the book, of the text, as I'm talking about Ona's status as a fugitive and her thinking about what could happen if she's caught and returned to Mount Vernon. Washington remained vigilant about any and all escape attempts from Mount Vernon, even while he was living in Philadelphia. Although the president reportedly avoided the tearing apart of slave families, he was not averse to punishing or selling difficult slaves when he deemed appropriate. During the early 1790s, Washington sold at least two difficult slaves to the Caribbean, after their maddening defiance could not be controlled. Washington threatened a slave named Ben that he would no longer tolerate disobedience and that, quote, if a stop is not, and this is Washington writing, if a stop is not put to his rogueries and other villainies by fair means and shortly, I will ship him off as I did Wagoneer Jack for the West Indies, where he will have no opportunity of playing such pranks as he is at present engaged in. In 1791, the enslaved Wagoneer Jack was sold for a quantity of wine. Aside from knowing that her master was not beyond selling a slave for serious infractions of the rules, Judge also understood that the slaves at Mount Vernon were subjected to physical violence. In January of 1793, Washington condoned the whipping of Judge's sister-in-law, Charlotte. Mount Vernon estate manager Anthony Whiting wrote to the president about a disobedient seamstress and recounted Charlotte's constant insubordination. Whiting wrote that he gave a very good whipping, and his plans for continued physical violence were made clear when he stated that he was, quote, determined to lower her spirit or skin her back, end quote. Washington responded to Whiting, stating, quote, and if she or any other of the servants will not do their duty by fair means or are impertinent, correction as the only alternative, must be administered.
Did Washington ever express any moral discomfort about owning slaves?
He did. And I think that this sort of shows us that he was a human being, flawed, having done great things for a new nation, but also was struggling with this idea about slavery, that he wrote on several occasions that he wished, quote, he wished to get quit of his Negroes, that he was thinking about trying to end slavery for his enslaved men and women. But he argued that he would be tearing apart families, that many of his slaves had intermarried with Martha Washington slaves, so he couldn't do it for that reason.
Mm-hmm. And in the end, he freed his slaves upon his death.
Well, yes, in his will, he writes, or has written, that his slaves, not Martha Washington's, but his slaves, were to be emancipated upon the death of Martha. So, of course, this makes Martha say, okay, great, the only thing standing between these people's freedom is my life. Okay, lovely.
Makes you a little nervous.
And she was writing these letters to Abigail Adams, talking about these suspicious fires at Mount Vernon. She was worried, mm-hmm. with good cause. And so she makes the decision to emancipate George Washington's slaves early. She doesn't, you know, that was smart. But she never sets any of her slaves free. Simply George's slaves. And I think that we... The sort of narrative around George Washington has given him a pass on slavery because of that action, mm-hmm. because he was one of the few founding fathers to make the decision to emancipate his slaves upon Martha's death. But, you know, I think we also have to step back, and I argue in the book that George Washington had no biological children. He and Martha never had children together. Martha had children from her first husband. But George and Martha did not. And I think we really have to ask ourselves the question that if there was a George Jr., would he have been so quick to emancipate over 120 people? That was a tremendous amount of wealth. And when we think about the 18th century and the importance of inheritance, it's not just your name, it's your wealth. Would he have made that decision? Of course, we don't know the answer to it, but I think that he's given an opportunity because he has no heirs of his own, direct heirs, that allows him to act on what his conscience was telling him. He did in death what he would not do while he was living.
There's so much more in this book. I wish we had an hour to talk about it. But give us, before we end, give us a quick idea of what Ona's life was like in freedom. It wasn't easy.
No. I'll do my best because I don't want to tell you all everything. I want you to read the book.
You need to read the book.
Buy some books. They make good gifts. You know... I wanted the other part of the book that I wanted to make certain was included was what it meant to be a fugitive and to live in the North as a fugitive. She lived in hiding, basically, for nearly half a century. Ona outlived everybody. And her life was far from easy. She lived and endured what many free people, formerly enslaved people, fugitives lived. It was difficult, even with the title of being a free person. And so I always ask my students the question, how free is free when slavery exists? What does it mean to be a free person if you can be kidnapped and dragged into the jaws of slavery? Perhaps an institution that you've never known in your life. And so Ona lived with this, and when asked in the interviews that she left at the end of her life if she regretted her decision because her life had been difficult, she says, absolutely not, that she was made a child of God by her escape, and she had no regrets.
Thank you. It's a wonderful, eye-opening book.
Thank you.
I encourage all of you, if you don't have a copy, buy it after our program. And if you have a copy, please read it. Incredible amount of detail and information and well-researched work. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nancy McLean's book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. And as the title suggests, it's a deep dive into the philosophy and the strategies that animate many of those on the political right in our country. At its center is a conflict as old as the country, the conflict between economic liberty, the freedom to pursue your own economic goals without unwanted regulation and taxation, and on the other side, majority rule, the right of the majority to tax and regulate your economic activity, to support public goods like clean air and good public schools and social security. Mm-hmm. Thanks for joining us here this evening, Nancy.
I'm pleased to be here, although I might prefer to continue listening to Erica. It's so interesting.
Well, there are two main characters. You have some characters in your book, too.
Yes.
Two main characters who've generated this energy for the America's right wing and libertarian politics. One is the Nobel Prize-winning economist James Buchanan, who provided the intellectual framework for the political right. The other is the billionaire industrial Charles Koch, who has provided much of the money behind the movement. And I'm wondering if we could start with the lesser known of these two, Professor James Buchanan. Give us a sketch of who he was, and I think you can read us something from the beginning of your book that will help to give us the scope that we're going to hear about.
Sure, I'd be glad to. So this is from the very beginning of the book, from the introduction. As 1956 drew to a close, Colgate Whitehead Darden Jr., the president of the University of Virginia, feared for the future of his beloved state. The previous year, the U.S. Supreme Court had issued its second Brown versus Board of Education ruling, calling for the dismantling of segregation in public schools with all deliberate speed. In Virginia, outraged state officials responded with legislation to force the closure of any school that planned to comply. Some extremists called for ending public education entirely. Darden, who earlier in his career had been the governor, could barely stand to contemplate the damage such a rash move would inflict. Even the name of this plan, Massive Resistance, made his gentlemanly Virginia sound like Mississippi. On his desk was a proposal written by the man he had recently appointed chair of the economics department at UVA. 37-year-old James McGill Buchanan liked to call himself a Tennessee country boy, but Darden knew better. No less a figure than Milton Friedman had extolled Buchanan's potential. As Darden reviewed the document, he might have wondered if the newly hired economist had read his mind. For without mentioning the crisis at hand, Buchanan's proposal put in writing what Darden was thinking. Virginia needed to find a better way to deal with the incursion on states' rights represented by Brown. To most Americans living in the North, Brown was a ruling to end segregated schools, nothing more, nothing less. And Virginia's response was about race. But to men like Darden and Buchanan, two well-educated sons of the South who were deeply committed to its model of political economy, Brown boded a sea change on much more. States' rights, in effect, were yielding in preeminence to individual rights. It was not difficult for either Darden or Buchanan to imagine how such a court might rule if presented with evidence of the state of Virginia's archaic labor relations, its measures to suppress voting, or its efforts to buttress the power of reactionary rural whites by underrepresenting the moderate voters of the cities and suburbs of Northern Virginia. Federal meddling could rise to levels once unimaginable. James Buchanan was not a member of the Virginia elite, nor is there any explicit evidence to suggest that for a white Southerner of his day, he was uniquely racist or insensitive to the concept of equal treatment. And yet somehow, all he saw in the Brown decision was coercion. Find the resources, he proposed to Darden, for me to create a new center on the campus of the University of Virginia, and I will use this center to create a new school of political economy and social philosophy. It would be an academic center, rigorously so, but one with a quiet political agenda, to defeat what Buchanan called the perverted form of liberalism that sought to destroy their way of life, a social order, as he described it, built on individual liberty, a term with its own coded meaning, but one that Darden surely understood. The center, Buchanan promised, would train a new line of thinkers in how to argue against those seeking to impose what he called an increasing role of government in economic and social life. He could win this war, and he would do it with ideas. Some may argue that while Darden fulfilled his part, he found the money to establish this center, he never got much in return. Buchanan's team had no discernible success in decreasing the federal government's pressure on the South all the way through the 1960s and 70s. But take a longer view. Follow the story forward to the second decade of the 21st century, and a different picture emerges, one that is both a testament to Buchanan's intellectual powers and, at the same time, the utterly chilling story of the ideological origins of the single most powerful and least understood threat to democracy today, the attempt by the billionaire-backed radical right to undo democratic governance.
Powerful writing and a powerful challenge. And you point out one of the disturbing ironies in Buchanan's logic as he develops his public choice logic echoed the same arguments that John Calhoun, South Carolina's senator, made about in defense of slavery before the Civil War.
Yes, it's very interesting, I think, especially resonant that we're paired together, Erica and I, on this panel, because Buchanan's own colleagues at George Mason University not long ago wrote an article calling John C. Calhoun, the pro-slavery South Carolina former vice president and senator, and also until Buchanan, the most anti-democratic theorist in American history, but a quite brilliant man who wrote two long treatises on government, Buchanan's own colleagues called John C. Calhoun a precursor to Buchanan's theory of public choice and said that the two schools of thought, and I'm quoting, had the same purpose and effect. That purpose and effect is this intense commitment to the absolute dominance of property rights over all other considerations. Economic liberty to the point is the support of economic liberty to the point where it trumps political liberty, human rights, all kinds of other social concerns and values. So it was quite stunning for me to read that they had written this because I could see it in the sources, but it was something to see it written by them. And I should mention also that John C. Calhoun's theories had been revived by the leaders of Virginia's massive resistance to fight the Brown versus Board of Education decision, but to do so on constitutional grounds, what one of the people who revived them, the key person who revived them, called raising the issue above the sordid terrain of race.
And you mentioned Charles Koch as the billionaire mm-hmm. industrialist, as the leading advocate for this now and the sponsor of it mm-hmm. with his billions of dollars. For those who don't know him, give us a brief profile mm-hmm. And tell us how Koch became involved and influenced this movement.
So Charles Koch is a quite brilliant man. I think he's been grossly underestimated by a lot of his critics. He has three engineering degrees from MIT. He took basically a fossil fuel corporation that he inherited from his father, who was one of the founders of the John Birch Society, if you've heard of that, in the late 1950s, an extreme conservative group. But he took that company and increased its value. Estimates vary between 1,000 times over and 5,000 times over. But he did that by playing a very long game, thinking very strategically over a long period of time. Over that same period of time, he also became more and more committed to libertarian ideas and deeply immersed in them by his own description to the point of obsession. And he has promoted them. He has funded libertarian intellectuals since the 1960s, looking hundreds by his own description, looking for a strategy, what he calls a technology, that would allow him to break through with this set of ideas that's not very popular in public life. There are very few people who actually support the full-on version of these ideas. Usually polls show between 3% and 4%, and yet this is someone who's quite accustomed to having his way, who has built this multinational corporation, who has a sense of his own significance in the world and a quite messianic vision. And with Buchanan's ideas, he found in his terms, the technology that would enable this breakthrough. And in 1997, began investing in a significant way in Buchanan Center at George Mason. I think it's also worth saying that was, you know, more than a decade before President Obama was elected. So that was certainly provided assistance to this cause in the reaction of many whites to that election. But Charles Koch was thinking about this, playing a very long game and investing in a number of operations that would be part of this
And how are we seeing this philosophy now applied practically in our political life?
Yeah, well, and maybe I should say, too, that the reason my book is called Democracy in Chains is that Buchanan made his life's mission from the 1970s forward trying to find a way to, in his terms, enchain Leviathan, right, to prevent a government that he thought was too powerful from growing. But he made very clear as the years went on that he was actually talking about the democracy part. And he actually said that Adam Smith was developing his ideas before the demos had been unchained. An interesting quote, given what Erica has described for us, because, of course, Adam Smith was writing while slavery prevailed across the world, and Buchanan was kind of mourning that and saying maybe those ideas could work then, but they can't work now that there is mass inclusive democracy. And so Koch became very interested in those ideas and began funding an apparatus to enable this enchaining of democracy that includes many things that we've seen, particularly since the 2010 midterm elections in states around the country. So new measures to suppress voting rights, a degree of voter suppression that we've not seen in this country since the late 19th century, the most radical gerrymander we've ever seen in American history, most sophisticated and radical gerrymander to make it so the officials elected after those 2010 midterms in this Republican Party that's been weaponized by these ideas and transformed, to make it so that those elected officials would be choosing their voters through redistricting rather than voters choosing their elected officials. So it's really another way of stealing votes, destroying labor unions, particularly public sector unions, without actually saying that that's what you're trying to do. So there's a whole series of ways in which various arms of this Koch enterprise have worked to enchain our democracy, to limit collective power, to underrepresent people who would oppose their agenda, and so forth. So it's, and also I should say, investing more and more in higher education too. At this point, 350 universities, up from 7 in 2005. So a quite far-flung, integrated, and long-term strategy
is underway. And you can see some of the results of this in the current makeup on Capitol Hill. You have strong Republican mm-hmm. majorities with fewer votes than the Democrats had in all, if you put all the congressional elections together.
Yes.
Millions mm-hmm. fewer votes.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So in my own state, Democrats should have, by the pure numbers, a majority of the congressional seats, but they don't have anything like that because of this redistricting. Another thing that we see, too, is the way that implying Buchanan's ideas about, he always argued that if you didn't like the outcome of public policy over the long term, don't think about changing the rulers, but think about changing the rules. And so that's what has happened with this Koch network. And one place you see that is that the Republican Party has been transformed. So I'm sure there are many Republican voters, lifetime Republican voters in this room, like my own father who died in 2000, but who would not recognize his party today. And the reason for that is that using this very smart strategy of funding primary challenges from the right against any Republican official who doesn't toe the line of the donors, they have created an unprecedented degree of discipline in that party, which we saw with the three health care bills of last year. None of them ever polled above 18%. Not one of them had support from the majority of any state or most Republican voters, and yet Republicans in the Senate were, you know, dead set on pushing them through in radical haste without the traditional rules, and the reason for that was the donor influence and the donor control. And they've actually, leading operatives in the Koch empire have actually boasted of that, calling it, referring to it as the accountability play, and calling it our secret sauce, so to speak, that these elected officials have been made accountable to these extreme ideological donors rather than even their own party's voters.
One of the places you can see most clearly the goals of mm-hmm. James Buchanan and Charles Koch is in Chile.
Yes.
Where Buchanan advised the dictatorship of Pinochet, on how to change the Constitution and change the politics of Chile. Can you describe a little bit about that? Give us some mm-hmm. of the highlights of what happened there and how it turned out in the end.
Yeah, this was a real surprise to me and was one of the ways in which I became intrigued with Buchanan. Many people of a certain age will have heard that Milton Friedman of the University of Chicago, a very well-known avid free market economist, went to Chile in 1975 to advise the Pinochet regime on inflation. A great deal has been written about that and said about it. He was widely condemned through his career, at least from, many people for that, because the Pinochet regime was kind of a poster case for the worst of human rights violations in the 1970s, having killed thousands of people, tortured many thousands more, destroyed all forms of popular collective power, the free press, and so forth. But what people, very few people knew, is that Buchanan went over, and his Virginia School of Political Economy had a more lasting impact in Chile under the dictatorship than Friedman's did. He was invited in 1980 when the dictatorship, it was actually a five-person military dictatorship, but they understood they would eventually have to go back to a system of representative government, but not wanting to give up anything that they'd achieved while the people had no power over government, wanted to write a new constitution. But they wanted that constitution to lock in everything that they'd done, including the full privatization of Social Security, the privatization of the education system, so Chile's system of higher education became the most expensive in the world, many other things. Buchanan is brought in to advise on that constitution. It's called the Constitution of Liberty. And in many ways, it made it impossible for the majority to make its will felt in Chile. So in 2013, Michelle Bachelet, a president who was elected by two-thirds of the Chilean people on a wide-ranging reform program, found that she had no power to act on that program because of what she called the authoritarian trammels of this constitution. And she said Chile needs a constitution without locks and bolts. But Buchanan was brought in there to put those locks and bolts in. And right now, it's not getting much attention in America because we're all paying attention to someone's tweets, but... take a week off. It'll be very good for your health. Pay attention to other things, including what I'm about to tell you, which is that we have never had a state-convened constitutional convention in America to amend the Constitution since it was created. We've amended it, you know, the other way through Congress and ratification by the states, but never a state-convened constitutional convention. There are now 28 states that have been lined up for such a constitutional convention to change our Constitution. You need 34 to call a convention. There are six states in which this radicalized Republican Party controls both houses of the legislature that have not yet authorized a convention. And the deficit run up by the tax bill passed in December that is predicted to be $1.5 trillion, at least, I believe will become the occasion to tip those remaining six states over and convene a constitutional convention somewhere in the next few years unless people start to pay better attention to this. So it's quite dramatic the way that Chilean experience is coming back to America, and we could be faced with a constitution of locks and bolts as well.
And we've also seen an attempt to privatize Social Security in the U.S. back in the early 2000s that was actually led by this group, mm-hmm. Charles Koch. And at the time, Chile was viewed as a poster child for privatizing Social Security. Talk a little bit about what mm-hmm. happened there and what the strategy was to try to get Americans to decide that mm-hmm. this popular program was time to end it or change it.
Yes.
Radically.
So in Chile, under the dictatorship, just about the time of this the drafting of this new constitution, just before it, a man named Sebastian Piñera, who was the Minister of Labor in Chile, led an effort to privatize Chile's Social Security. Since it was a dictatorship, people didn't have much of a choice. There was an essentially fraudulent plebiscite in which people, as they were saying with the constitution, you could vote yes or no, and the opposition couldn't organize or speak, so they privatized Social Security, and as you might imagine, when you take Social Security deposits away from the government, which can be a responsible actor paying attention to them, and you invest them with a financial sector that's been deregulated by law, trouble ensues. And what happened in Chile was like what happened here in 2008 with our deregulated financial sector, except for the Chileans, all of their Social Security savings had been invested in individual accounts with these private financial firms, which behaved abominably, like ours did, without regulation, and ended up losing the savings of untold numbers of Chilean people, just wiping out their retirements like that, and also gouging people. Some of them were charging as much as 25%. Per annum for these retirement accounts and so forth. So a real crisis for Chileans. But for people on the right, it looked like a success story. So Sebastian Piñera went on to be hired at Charles Koch's Cato Institute, where he works now promoting Social Security privatization worldwide. And soon after Chile privatized its Social Security, Koch's Cato Institute in the early 1980s made Social Security privatization its number one goal and plan and brought in this James Buchanan to advise on it, who started from the understanding that Social Security was a very popular program. And he went through all the demographics to say, nobody wants to change this program. Nobody wants to end this program. And he said, you know, black, white, brown, rich, poor, Rust Belt, Sun Belt, male, female. And instead of just saying, hey, gosh, it's a popular, effective program, people like it, let's leave it alone, he said, therefore, if you want to get rid of it, you shouldn't oppose it frontally because you'll be defeated. So he laid out a strategy for how to undermine it that involved misleading to suggest that it was not viable, that it wouldn't be viable for people, and then also a very sophisticated divide and conquer strategy to break up that once solid phalanx of support. And that's the kind of strategy that we're seeing now. But sadly, our journalists don't know enough when people say they want to reform Social Security to ask the simple question, do you believe in the principle of social insurance on which this program was founded? Because if they asked that follow-up question, we'd have a very different conversation.
You're expressing a significant amount of alarm at this development.
I feel it.
Yeah. But the U.S. Constitution already has significant checks on majority rule, put in by the founders to protect property. Are we just seeing a reemergence of that element of the Constitution, something that is less worrisome than you suggest?
That's a really interesting question, and it is true that actually the U.S. Constitution has more protections for minority rights, particularly the minority rights of the propertied, than any other constitution in the world. So political scientists speak of this in terms of veto points and the number of veto points on the majority in a constitutional system. Ours is the only one of the existing democracies that has four such veto points. Others have one, maybe two, maybe three. We have four. So it's already extremely solicitous of the wealthy and the very comfortable, and that's why it's so difficult to act on things like the extreme levels of inequality that we have in our country now, healthcare, all of these other kinds of problems are exacerbated by that system. So that's one thing that makes me think that what these folks are doing is really quite serious, because we're talking about a constitution that already makes it nearly impossible for the majority to make its will felt, and they're saying that's inadequate. And Buchanan himself actually said that every existing, just to give you a sense of how sweeping and radical this vision was, every existing constitution in the world was a failure as far as protecting the rights of the people who don't want to be taxed. So that's where he started from, and that's where Calhoun started from, too, because he was afraid of the emerging anti-slavery minority. So I wish that I felt more security and comfort with the situation now. I don't. And I think I'm in growing company with that. I don't know, some people may have come across a new book that's called How Democracies Fail by two comparative political scientists that look at the history of the 20th century in places, you know, sort of broadly right and left, and show what happens to how democracies go under. And they're really sounding alarm about ours, and they go through a whole series of reasons for that. But I think what I've been talking about in terms of the radical rules changes that have already been pushed through in the 30 states that are controlled by this cause to the point of what the Democracy Alliance calls electoral stranglehold, that the changes have been so significant and now at the federal level are so significant that I think this is an all hands on deck moment for people in this country who care about democracy. You know, really, we have to pay attention. There are really, really important things happening here. And as a historian, I believe that this moment, it's not as dramatic, but I think it's very much akin to the 1860s and the 1930s in terms of a very determined and powerful group of people who are hostile to democracy,
as the Confederacy was or the American Liberty League was in the 1930s, and they are moving along very successfully. And I think it's a time for all of us who really care about a government that's able to do things like provide for our retirement security, act on discrimination, care for the health of our planet. All of those things are really at risk right now. So I really hope that people will pay close mm-hmm. attention.
Obviously, your book paints a negative picture of the libertarian right wing of American politics, and a number of people have called you out, mm-hmm. saying you, taking quotes out of context, unfairly treating Mr. Buchanan. Are you surprised at the negative response from those groups?
No, I actually predicted it on page 232, if you choose to look. These guys are doing to me what they've been doing to climate scientists for some time now and tobacco researchers before them. So it's a kind of attack the messenger strategy as right. a way to blow smog in the public conversation and avoid dealing with the substance of the research and the findings. So I knew to expect it, but that said, it's quite different to experience it in real time. You know, it's affecting you. But I think that it also shows that this is a book that these people don't want others to read. And I think they also don't want their own lower-level staff to read, because I don't think everybody's in on what the real strategy and the end game are. And I don't think they also want young people to read it. This cause is recruiting young people with lavish fellowships. They've been doing it at the college level and the graduate level for some time now. They're now talking about upping that by a factor of 10, and they've gone into the high schools. So they really want young people, and I think they really don't want young people to know what it's all about until they've been properly sorted. So, yeah.
Thanks, You're Nancy. Welcome. Again, another riveting and very provocative book, one that's likely to reverberate for a long time in our politics. Thank you. So let's talk a little bit about making these books, nonfiction writing. Let's start with the research. Both of you kind of stumbled upon these stories, these riveting stories in research for other things. Tell us how you came to upon this story.
I started research on what became this book in 2006, and at that time I'd never heard of James McGill Buchanan, so don't feel bad if you haven't. Most people haven't, if you're not in the fields in which he worked or these organizations on the right. And I'd also never heard of Charles Koch, which most of us hadn't if we weren't in the fossil fuel industry or the libertarian movement. I was actually researching the story of the Prince Edward County, Virginia school closures, where this Southside County in Virginia essentially punished the black population, particularly the students. Students had led 100, which is interesting, the gun control student organizing, but the students in this county had organized, led by this amazing young woman, Barbara Rose Johns. They had organized 100% solid student strike for a better high school and stayed out for 2 weeks, gotten the help of the NAACP. Their case became one of those folded into Brown versus Board of Education, and when it came time to desegregate the Prince Edward County schools, the county officials responded by saying, no, we'll just go out of the public school business entirely. That's a quote. And they shut down the entire public school system in this county. They posted no trespassing signs. They padlocked the doors. And they left black children with no formal education whatsoever for 5 years. Kids that were about to enter first grade up till 12th grade, no education, while the white kids went off to a private segregation academy. I learned that this was part of the state of Virginia's massive resistance to Brown versus Board of Education, that vouchers were integral to that, that Milton Friedman had been involved in that. So anyway, I was researching that story, and I came across a report by Buchanan and a footnote, and it just so shocked me that it put him on my radar, and I started following him. And then when I heard that, you know, just in a passing reference, that his Virginia school had played more of a role in Chile than Friedman's Chicago school, I took notice, and then I moved to North Carolina in 2010, where this agenda was rolled out, and I could see that it was his ideas weaponized. So he became the focus, and I shifted my book.
So when you're writing nonfiction of the type that you're doing, how much time is research and how much time is actual writing, would you say?
That's kind of hard to quantify. Mm-hmm. Because I think that even when we're writing, we're still doing some research. For me, it took 9 years to write this book. And that was 9 years of research and writing. I think most historians collect as much information as mm-hmm. we can at first, right? That gives us the skeleton to write the book.
But I found myself always needing to find a little bit more, yeah, or to go back in, to dive back in. And, you know, I think that becomes, that's just what we're supposed to do. Like, our profession, mm-hmm, mandates that. So even though this book is written, it doesn't mean that some documents won't appear in, mm-hmm, somebody's grandmother's trunk somewhere that tells a different, maybe a slightly different version, or adds nuance. And we'll continually go back and draw from sources and do more research, mm-hmm, and revise. That's the profession.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting. I mean, we both had this experience of writing these books with commercial presses after writing other books with university presses. And I'll just speak for myself here, but I worked my heart out on my previous big research work, Freedom Is Not Enough, and was really sad to see that it was impossible to penetrate the public conversation with an academic book, even though it was very policy relevant. And so I didn't want to work my heart out again without being able to actually talk to people and engage in conversations like this. But I had to really reinvent myself. Yep. And there's a myth among some scholars that suggests that, and granted, there's various quality, you know, distinctions among commercial presses and books and so forth, but some people think that it's somehow less prestigious or less hard work to write, you know, a book that people will want to read. sorry. But in my experience, yeah, it was the work was so much harder, and I found that I had to do much, much better research because I had to know every single moment of the narrative, and I had to know who was doing what and really understand character and really understand motivations and be able to set scenes in a way that I didn't really have to in my, right, previous academic work. So this was the hardest work I ever did. It really was painful sometimes, but it has really, yeah, been gratifying to be able to produce a piece of work that is really speaking to people beyond the academy, and that has helped me be part of, I think, what is a pretty crucial conversation in our society now among people who are in motion, who really care about the future of our country. So that's been fun, but it was, yeah, not easy.
Well,
Many drafts, I would say to the young people here, yeah, draft after draft, yeah, after draft. Edit. Welcome all criticism. It will help, yeah, you do better, even if you sometimes want to cry when you first get it.
Is there a key? I mean, you've got all of this research. I mean, I know this is a reporter. I take all of this research, and I'm supposed to make it into something that people will want to listen to, where there's a storyline, a narrative.
Yeah.
How do you, is there a key to doing that? Was there a key when you, or is it just hard work?
Well, I mean, I think it's hard work, mm-hmm, but I do, for me, you know, Ona was such a compelling person. Like, her story was just so compelling that I knew from the moment that I started working on this project that it would have to be written for a general audience, that I didn't want to write another book that was read just by academics. You know, we do that because we want to be in conversation with each other as scholars. And not every project, yeah, is good for a general, mm-hmm, audience, right? But knowing what I was learning about Ona, it became clear to me that I could use her life, her biography, to tell multiple stories. And this is just sort of a part of who I am, and the importance that I give to access to education. I was talking about this earlier today with students, that this is history that everyone should have. You shouldn't have to be a student or a faculty member at a college where you pay tuition to learn, right? And I wanted to do deep scholarly research and present that to a large audience. And the only way you can do that is if you write it in a way that makes them want, mm-hmm, to read it. This is about, for me, educational accessibility. And to me, that's a civil right that I think we need to spend a little more time thinking about. But it also gave me the right to write in a way that felt more natural to me.
Mm-hmm. I would say that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
it's the right brain, left brain working, yep, together finally.
Thanks to both of you again for your books and for spending this time with us tonight. We really appreciate it. Let's give them a round of applause.
Thank you.